moment-to-moment awareness. We are patient with ourselves. As we carefully move up to our limits in a stretch, for instance, we practice breathing at that limit, dwelling in the creative space between not challenging the body at all and pushing it too far. This is a far cry from most exercise and aerobics classes, and even many yoga classes which only focus on what the body is doing. These approaches tend to emphasize progress. Most of us need to be given permission to switch from the doing mode to the being mode, mostly because we have been conditioned since we were little to value doing over being. To inhabit the domain of being or being mode, we need to learn and practice mobilizing our powers of attention and awareness during exercise. Professional and even amateur athletes are now realizing that unless they pay attention to the mind as well as the body, they are disregarding an entire realm of personal power that can make a critical difference in performance. Time and again, our patients with pain problems report that their physical therapy sessions go much better when they use awareness of breathing as they perform their exercises. It's as if a whole new dimension of what they are being asked to do is revealed to them, and their physical therapists often comment on the dramatic changes they seem to have undergone. In the stress reduction clinic, the ground rule is that every individual has to consciously take responsibility for reading his or her own body's signals while doing the yoga. This means listening carefully to what your body is telling you and honoring its messages, erring on the side of being conservative. What you learn from doing this is that no matter what the state of your body, when you bring awareness to it and work at your limits, those limits tend to recede over time. The reason it is so important for people with health problems to work at their limits, similar to the way athletes do, is that when there is something, quote, wrong with one part of your body, you tend to back off and not use any of it. This is a sensible short-term protection mechanism when you are sick or injured. The body needs periods of rest for recuperation and recovery. But often the short-term solution evolves into the long-term lifestyle. Over time, especially if we have an injury or a problem with our body, a restricted body image can creep into our view of ourselves, and if we are unaware of this inner process, we can come to identify ourselves that way and believe it. We begin to build our psychological life around our preoccupations with our illness, injury, or disability, while the rest of our life is on hold and unfortunately atrophying along with the body. When the body is given complete bed rest, say when you are recuperating from surgery in the hospital, it rapidly loses a good deal of muscle mass, especially in the legs. This is called disuse atrophy. But it's not just the leg muscles that atrophy with disuse. All skeletal muscles do. They also tend to get shorter and lose their tone and become more prone to injury in people who lead a sedentary lifestyle. The need to conceptualize health and illness in a larger framework than the traditional one has led to the formulation of a new paradigm, still in its infancy, but already having substantial repercussions in the practice of medicine. One of those repercussions has been the development of a new field within medicine, known variously as behavioral medicine or mind-body medicine or integrative medicine, which is devoted to a deeper understanding of what we mean by health, and to explore how we can best promote health and prevent disease, and how we can best treat and heal the diseases and disabilities we do experience. This new development in medicine recognizes that our thought patterns and emotions may play a significant role in health and disease. It recognizes that what people believe about their bodies and their illnesses may be important for healing, and that how we live our lives, what we think, and what we do may all influence our health in important ways. The field of integrative and behavioral medicine offers new hope for people who ordinarily tend to fall through the cracks of the healthcare system and come away unhelped, frustrated, and bitter. By involving people in this expanded definition of medicine and healthcare in a participatory way, integrative medicine helps people to shift the balance of responsibility for their well-being away from an exclusive dependency on their doctors and closer to their own personal efforts, which they have more direct control over than they do over hospitals, medical procedures, and doctors. Although we are often unaware of our thoughts as thoughts, they have a profound effect on everything we do, and they can have a profound effect on our health as well, which can be for better or for worse. Our thought patterns dictate the way we perceive and explain reality, including our relationship to ourselves and to the world. We all have particular ways in which we think about and explain to ourselves why things happen to us. Our very thought patterns underlie our motives for doing things and for making choices. They influence the degree of confidence we have in our ability to make things happen. They are at the core of our beliefs about the world, how it works, and what our place in it is. Dr. Martin Seligman and his colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania, under the rubric of positive psychology, have been studying health differences between people who can be identified as being basically optimistic or basically pessimistic. Some people tend to be pessimistic in the way they explain to themselves the causes of a bad event. This pattern involves blaming themselves for the bad things that happened to them, thinking that the effects of whatever happened will last a long time, and that the bad event will affect many different aspects of their lives. Dr. Seligman refers to this attributional style, as it is technically called, as the "it's me, it's going to last forever, it's going to affect everything I do" pattern. Some people call this mode of thinking catastrophizing. An example of this style might be the reaction, "I always knew I was stupid and this proves it. I can never do anything right," when you experience a failure of some kind. An optimist experiencing the same event would see it quite differently. People who are optimists tend not to blame themselves for bad events, or if they do, they see them more as momentary events which will become resolved. Anybody can have any or all of these negative thoughts, and many others as well. They may come in and go out of your mind at different times in reaction to the headache. As with any other reaction, the challenge here is to shift your attention so that you can see them as thoughts, and in doing so, welcome the headache into the present moment, because it's here anyway, like it or not. Can you decipher its message by directing careful attention to how your body feels right now? Are you aware now of a mood or emotion that may have preceded your realizing that you had a headache? Was there an event that triggered it that you can identify? What are you feeling right now emotionally? Are you feeling anxious, depressed, sad, angry, disappointed, discouraged, annoyed? Can you breathe with the sensations of the headache, the pounding feeling in the temples, or whatever it is? Can you just watch your feelings and thoughts and see them as just feelings and thoughts? Can you catch yourself identifying with them as my feelings, my anger, my thoughts, my headache, and let go of the my and just accept the moment as it is? When you look into the headache, seeing the constellation of thoughts and feelings, the reacting, the judging, the rejecting of how you're feeling, the wishing to feel differently that may be going on in your mind, perhaps you will realize at a certain point that you are not your headache, unless you go along with this inner process of identification, unless you yourself make it your headache. Maybe it is just a headache, or maybe it is just a feeling in the head that doesn't need a name at all right now. The ways we use language tell us a lot about the automatic way we personalize our symptoms and illnesses. For instance, we say, "I have a headache," or "I have a cold," or "I have a fever," when it would be more accurate to say something like, "The body is headaching," or "colding," or "fevering." When we automatically and unconsciously link each symptom we experience to I and my, the mind is already creating a certain amount of trouble for us. By seeing the headache or the cold as a process, we're acknowledging that it is dynamic and not static, that it is not ours, but it is rather an unfolding process that we are experiencing. When you look into a symptom with the full power of mindfulness, whether it is muscle tension, rapid heartbeats, shortness of breath, fever, or pain, It gives you much more of a chance to remember to honor your body and listen to the messages it is trying to give you. Usually, your body will try desperately to get its messages through to you despite the bad connection with conscious awareness. A priest described his medical history in class one day this way. Looking at it after having been practicing the meditation for a few weeks, it seemed to him that his body had been trying to get him to slow down his fast-paced type A lifestyle by giving him headaches at work. But he didn't listen, even though the headaches got worse. So his body gave him an ulcer, but he still didn't listen. Finally, it sent him a mild heart attack, which scared him so much that he started to listen. He actually said that he felt grateful for his heart attack and took it as a gift, because, he said, it could have killed him, but it didn't. It gave him another chance. He felt this could well be his final chance to start taking his body seriously, to listen to its messages, and to honor them. The most important part of the work of mindfulness is to keep your practice alive. The way you do that is to do it. It needs to become part of your life in the same way that eating is or working is. We keep the practice alive by making time for being, for non-doing, no matter how much rearranging it takes. Making a time for formal practice every day is like feeding yourself every day. It's that important. So beyond the 8-week practice schedule, here are some suggestions to keep your practice alive. Sit every day. If you feel the sitting is your major form of practice, sit for at least 20 minutes at a time, and preferably 30 to 45 minutes. If you feel the body scan is your major form of practice, then make sure you sit as well for at least 5 to 10 minutes per day. If you are having a bad day and have absolutely no time, you tell yourself, then sit for 3 minutes or even 1 minute. Anybody can find 3 minutes or 1 minute. But when you do it, let it be a minute of concentrated non-doing, letting go of time for that minute. Keep your focus on the breath for stability and calmness. If at all possible, try to sit in the morning. It will have a positive effect on your whole day. Other good times to practice are right away when you get home from work, before dinner, before lunch, at home or in your office, in the evening or late at night, especially if you're not tired, and ultimately, any time at all. Every moment is a good time for formal practice sometimes. If you feel the body scan is your major form of practice, then do it every day for at least 20 minutes at a time, and preferably 30 to 45 minutes. Practice the mindful yoga 4 or more times per week for 30 minutes or more. Make sure you're doing it mindfully, especially with awareness of breathing and bodily sensations, and resting between postures. Finally, just sit, just breathe, and if you feel like it, allow yourself to smile inwardly. As we have seen, the essence of mindfulness is paying attention on purpose. So keeping up the informal practice means paying attention, being awake, owning your moments. This can be great fun. You can ask yourself at any point, am I fully awake? Do I know what I'm doing right now? Am I fully present in the doing of it? How does my body feel right now? My breathing? What is my mind up to? We've touched on numerous strategies for bringing mindfulness into daily life. You can tune into standing, walking, listening, speaking, eating, and working. You can tune into your thoughts, your mood states and emotions, your motives for doing things or for feeling a certain way, and of course, the sensations in your body. You can tune into other people, children and adults, their body language, their tension, their feelings and speech, their actions and the consequences of those actions. You can tune into the larger environment, the feeling of the air on your skin, sounds of nature, light, color, form, movement. Focusing on the breath at your belly can be calming. Just as the surface of the ocean tends to be choppy when the wind is blowing, The mind, too, tends to be reactive and agitated when the outside environment is not calm and peaceful. In the case of the ocean, if you go down 10 or 20 feet, there is only a gentle swelling. There is calm even when the surface is agitated. Similarly, when we focus on our breathing down in the belly, we are tuning to a region of the body that is below the agitations of our thinking mind and is intrinsically calmer. This is a valuable way of reestablishing inner calmness and balance in the face of emotional upset or when you have a lot on your mind. In meditation, the breath functions as an anchor for our attention. Tuning to it anywhere we feel it in the body allows us to drop below the surface agitations of the mind into relaxation, calmness, and stability. The agitation is still at the surface, just as the waves are on the surface of the water, but we are out of the wind and protected from their buffeting action and their tension-producing effects when we shift our attention to the breath for a moment or two. This is an extremely effective way of locating a peaceful center within yourself. It enhances the overall stability of your mind. When you touch base in any moment with that part of your mind that is calm and stable, your perspective immediately changes. You can see things more clearly and act from inner balance rather than being tossed about by the agitations of your mind. This is one reason why focusing on the breath at your belly is so useful. Your belly is literally the center of gravity of your body, far below the head and the turmoil of your thinking mind. For this reason, we befriend the belly right from the beginning as an ally in establishing calmness and awareness. Any moment during the day that you bring your attention to your breathing in this way becomes a moment of meditative awareness. It is an effective way of tuning in to the present and orienting yourself to your body and to what you are feeling, not only while you are, quote, meditating, but also while you are going about living your life. When you practice mindfulness of breathing in this way, you may find it helpful in deepening your concentration to close your eyes. However, it is not always necessary to meditate with your eyes closed. If you decide to keep them open, let your gaze be unfocused on the surface in front of you or on the floor and keep it steady. Bring the same kind of sensitivity to feeling your breathing that we brought to eating the raisins. In other words, be mindful of what you are actually feeling from moment to moment. Keep your attention on the breath for the full duration of the in-breath and the full duration of the out-breath as best you can. And when you notice that your mind has wandered and is no longer on your breathing, just gently bring it back. Of course, the level of exercise has to be adjusted to the physical state of your body so that you're not pushing beyond your limits at any time, but are working in a target range for heart rate that produces what is called a training effect on the heart. Then you gradually increase your exercise as your limit recedes. Yoga is a wonderful form of exercise for a number of reasons. To begin with, it is very gentle. And the whole point of hatha yoga is that it can be done in any position. Yoga is also good exercise because it is a type of full body conditioning. It improves strength and flexibility in the entire body. It's like swimming in that every part of your body is involved in benefits. It can even have cardiovascular benefits when done vigorously. But the way we do it in MBSR is not as cardiovascular exercise. We do it primarily for stretching and strengthening your muscles and joints to wake up the body to its full range of motion and potential for movement. Perhaps the most remarkable thing about yoga is how much energy you feel after you do it. You can be feeling exhausted, do some yoga, and feel completely rejuvenated in a short period of time. Those people who have been practicing the body scan every day for 2 weeks in a row and found it difficult to feel relaxed are thrilled to discover in the third week of the MBSR program that they can easily achieve a deep state of relaxation with the yoga. It's almost impossible not to unless you have a chronic pain condition, in which case you have to be particularly careful of what you do. At the same time, many find that they stay awake during the yoga and get to taste feelings of stillness and peace that they did not experience in the body scan because they were unable to concentrate or fell asleep. I do yoga almost every day and have for over 40 years. I get out of bed and splash some cold water on my face to make sure I'm awake. Then I work with my body mindfully by doing some yoga. Some days it feels like my body is literally putting itself together as I practice. Other days it doesn't feel that way. But it always feels like I know how my body is today because I've spent some time with it in the morning, being with it, nourishing it, strengthening it, stretching it, listening to it. This feeling is very reassuring when you have physical problems and limitations and are never quite sure what your body is going to be like on any given day. Some days I'll do 15 minutes, just some basic back and leg and shoulder work. Sometimes I'll do half an hour or an hour, but even 5 or 10 minutes a day can be very useful as a regular routine. Yoga is a Sanskrit word that literally means yoke. The practice of yoga is the practice of yoking together or unifying body and mind, which really means penetrating into the experience of them not being separate in the first place. You can also think of it as experiencing the unity or connectedness between the individual and the universe as a whole. The image of the yoke goes nicely with our notions of reminding and rebodying. One of the most enjoyable and relaxing aspects of doing yoga mindfully is the sense of your body flowing from one posture to the next and through periods of stillness while lying on your back or on your belly. If you are drawn to the idea of practicing mindful yoga, you can make use of the guided mindfulness CDs obtainable from my website that go along with this book, the Series 1 CDs. Dr. Seligman and his colleagues have shown that people who have a highly pessimistic attributional style are at significantly higher risk for becoming depressed when they encounter a bad event than are people who have the optimistic way of thinking. Pessimists are also more likely to come down with physical symptoms and show hormonal and immune system changes characteristic of increased susceptibility to disease following a bad event than are optimists. In a study of cancer patients, these researchers showed that the worse the attributional style, the earlier the patient died of the disease. In another study, they showed that baseball players in the Hall of Fame who had a pessimistic attributional style when they were young and healthy, gleaned from direct quotes from newspaper articles, were more likely to die young than those who had an optimistic attributional style. Dr. Seligman's overall conclusion from these and other studies is that it is not the world per se that puts us at increased risk of illness, so much as how we see and think about what is happening to us. One thought pattern that appears to be extremely powerful for improving health status is what is called self-efficacy. Self-efficacy is a belief in your ability to exercise control over specific events in your life. It reflects confidence in your ability to actually do things, a belief in your ability to make things happen, even when you might have to face new, unpredictable, and stressful occurrences. Self-efficacy increases when you have experiences of succeeding at something you feel is important. For example, if you are practicing the body scan and as a result feel more in touch with your body and more relaxed, then that taste of success will lead you to feel more confident in your ability to relax when you want to. At the same time, such an experience will make it more likely that you will keep practicing the body scan. Dr. Suzanne Cabasa of the City University of New York has studied business executives, lawyers, bus drivers, telephone company employees, and other groups of people who all lead high-stress lives. In every group, as you might imagine, she found some people who were much healthier than others experiencing the same amount of stress. She wondered whether the healthier people had some personality characteristic in common that might be protecting them from the negative effects of high stress. She found that a particular psychological characteristic differentiated those who got sick often from those who stayed healthy. She called this characteristic psychological hardiness. Sometimes it is also referred to as stress hardiness. As with the other psychological factors we have looked at, hardiness too involves a particular way of seeing oneself in the world. According to Dr. Kubasa, stress-hardy individuals show high levels of three psychological characteristics: control, commitment, and challenge. People who are high in control have a strong belief that they can exert an influence on their surroundings, that they can make things happen. This sounds similar to self-efficacy. People who are high in commitment tend to feel fully engaged in what they are doing from day to day and are committed to giving these activities their best effort. People who are high in challenge see change as a natural part of life that affords at least some chance for further development. This view allows stress-hardy individuals to see new situations more as opportunities and less as threats than might other people who do not share this orientation toward life as an ongoing challenge. As we examine research relating thought patterns and emotional factors to health, it's important for us to keep firmly in mind that it is always dangerous and almost always wrong to assume that because a connection has been found between certain personality traits or behaviors and a disease, this means that being a certain way or thinking a certain way causes you to get a particular disease. It is more accurate to say that it may increase to some extent, that extent depending on the strength of the correlation and a lot of other factors, your risk of getting the disease. The next time you hit your thumb with a hammer or bang your shin on the car door, you can perform a little experiment in mindfulness. See if you can observe the explosion of sensations and the expanding shell of screamed epithets, groans, and violent body movements that ensue. It all takes place within a second or two. In that time, if you're quick enough to bring mindfulness to the sensations you are feeling, you may notice that you stop swearing or yelling or groaning and that your movements become less violent. As you observe the sensations in the hurt area, notice how they are changing, how sensations of stinging, throbbing, cutting, burning, rending, shooting, aching, and many others may flow in rapid succession through the region, blending into each other like a play of multicolored lights projected willy-nilly on a screen. Keep following the flow of sensations as you hold the area or put ice on it or put it under cold water or hold it above your head or whatever you are drawn to do. In conducting this little experiment, you may notice if your concentration is strong, a center of calmness within yourself from which you can observe the entire episode unfold. It can feel as if you are completely detached from the sensations you are experiencing, as if it were not your pain so much as just pain. Perhaps you felt a sense of being calm within the pain or behind the pain. If you didn't, you can always try it again the next time you are unfortunate enough to bang some part of your body really hard. Hitting your thumb with a hammer or banging your shin on something brings on immediate pain. We use the term acute pain to describe pain that comes on suddenly. Acute pain is usually very intense, but it also only lasts a short while. If you try to bring mindfulness to exactly what you are feeling in those moments when you hurt yourself accidentally, you will probably find that how you relate to the sensations you experience makes a big difference in the degree of pain you actually feel and how much you suffer. It also affects your emotions and your behavior. It can be quite a revelation to discover that you have a range of options for dealing with physical pain, even very intense pain, aside from just being automatically overwhelmed by it. From the standpoint of health and medicine, chronic pain is a much more intractable problem than acute pain. By chronic pain, we mean pain that persists over time and that is not easily relieved. Chronic pain can be either constant or it can come and go. It can also vary greatly in intensity, from excruciating to dull and aching. Medicine manages acute pain far better than it does chronic pain. The underlying cause of an acute pain can usually be identified rapidly and treated, resulting in elimination of the pain. But sometimes pain persists and does not respond well to the most common remedies for pain, namely drugs and surgery, and its cause may not be well defined. If it lasts more than 6 months or keeps coming back over extended periods of time, then a pain problem that started out as acute is said to have become chronic. As long as you are awake, you can be mindful. All it takes is wanting to and remembering to bring your attention into the present moment. Once again, it's important to emphasize that paying attention does not mean thinking about. It means directly perceiving what you are attending to. Your thoughts will only be a part of your experience. Here are some additional awareness exercises you may find useful. 1. Try to be mindful for 1 minute in every hour. 2. Touch base with your breathing throughout the day wherever you are, as often as you can. 3. For 1 week, be aware of one pleasant event per day while it's happening. Record these, as well as your thoughts, feelings, and bodily sensations, in a calendar and look for patterns. 4. During another week, do the same for one unpleasant or stressful event per day while it is happening. Again, record your bodily sensations, thoughts, feelings, and reactions or responses. Look for underlying patterns. 5. Bring awareness to one difficult communication per day during another week and record what happened, what you wanted from the communication, what the other person wanted, and what actually transpired in a similar calendar. Look for patterns over the week. Does this exercise tell you anything about your own mental states and their consequences as you communicate with others? 6. Bring awareness to the connections between physical symptoms of distress that you might be having, such as headaches, increased pain, palpitations, rapid breathing, muscle tension, and preceding mental states and their origins. Keep a calendar of these for one full week. 7. Be mindful of your needs for formal meditation, relaxation, exercise, a healthy diet, enough sleep, intimacy and affiliation, and humor, and honor them. These needs are the mainstays of your health. If adequately attended to on a regular basis, they will provide a strong foundation for health, increase your resilience to stress, and lend greater satisfaction and coherence to your life. 8. After a particularly stressful day or event, make sure that you take steps to decompress and restore balance that very day, if at all possible. In particular, meditation, cardiovascular exercise, sharing time with friends, and getting enough sleep will help in the recovery process. In summary, every moment of your waking life is a moment to which you might bring greater stillness and awareness. Our suggestions for how to do this will pale next to your own as you cultivate mindfulness in your life. One simple way of bringing awareness into your daily life is to practice walking meditation. As you might guess, this means bringing your attention to the actual experience of walking as you are doing it. It means simply walking and knowing that you are walking. It does not mean looking at your feet. Usually we walk for a reason. The most common one is that we want to go from one place to another, and walking is how we can best do it. Of course, the mind tends to think about where it wants to go and what it is going to do there, and it presses the body into service to deliver it there, so to speak. If the mind is in a hurry, then the body rushes. If the mind is attracted to something it finds interesting, then the head turns and your body may change direction or stop. And of course, thoughts of all kinds are cascading through the mind just as they are when you are sitting and breathing. All this happens without the least awareness. Walking meditation involves intentionally attending to the experience of walking itself. It involves focusing on the sensations in your feet or your legs, or alternatively, feeling your whole body moving. You can also integrate awareness of your breathing with the experience of walking. We begin by making an effort to be fully aware as one foot contacts the ground, as the weight shifts to it, as the other foot lifts and moves ahead and then comes down to make contact with the ground in its turn. As with all the other methods we've been exploring, when the mind wanders away from the feet or the legs or the feeling of the body walking, we simply bring it back when we become aware of it. To deepen our concentration, we do not look around at the sights, but keep our gaze focused in front of us. We also don't look at our feet. They know how to walk quite well on their own. Because we tend to live so unconsciously, we take things like the ability to walk very much for granted. When you start paying more attention to it, you will appreciate that it is an amazing balancing act of locomotion. When we practice walking meditation, we are not trying to get anywhere. To reinforce this message, we walk in circles around the room or back and forth in lanes. This helps put the mind to rest because it literally has no place to go and nothing interesting happening to keep it entertained. You can practice mindful walking at any pace. We sometimes do it very slowly so that one step might take a minute. This allows you to really be with each movement from moment to moment, but we also practice it at a more natural pace. More evidence relating emotional factors to cancer came from researchers at King's College Hospital in London who conducted a study on women with breast cancer. Doctors Greer and Morris conducted in-depth psychological interviews with 160 women as they were admitted to the hospital for a lump in the breast before it was known whether or not it was cancerous. At the time of the interview, all the women were under the equal stress of not knowing whether they had cancer or not. The interviews with the women and with their husbands and other relatives were used as a means of measuring the degree to which the women concealed or expressed their feelings. The majority of women who were later found not to have breast cancer had what these researchers termed a normal pattern of emotional expression. However, the majority of women who were later found to have breast cancer had either a lifelong pattern of extreme suppression of their feelings, for the most part anger, or of exploding with emotion. Both extremes were associated with a higher risk of cancer. However, it was much more common for these women to suppress their feelings than to be exploders. In a 5-year follow-up of 50 of these women with breast cancer, all of whom had been treated surgically, these researchers found that those women who were judged to be facing their situation 3 months after surgery with what they called a fighting spirit, that is, a highly optimistic attitude and a belief in their own ability to survive, were much more likely to be alive than those who at 3 months had adopted either an attitude of stoic acceptance toward their disease or who were completely overwhelmed by it and felt helpless, hopeless, and defeated. Women who denied altogether that they had cancer and refused to discuss the subject and who showed no emotional distress about their situation were also much more likely to survive to 5 years. The results of this study suggest that emotions may play some role in cancer survival. But whether psychological factors played a causal or exacerbating role in a particular disease in a particular person will never be known with certainty. There is evidence that suppressing emotional expression may play a role in hypertension as well as cancer. In this area, the focus has been primarily on anger. People who habitually express anger when provoked by others have lower average blood pressures than people who habitually suppress such feelings. Perhaps the greatest scientific scrutiny of personality factors in relationship to chronic disease has focused on the question of whether or not there is a heart disease-prone personality. It is important for the listener to keep firmly in mind the fact that all patients who are referred to the stress reduction clinic have a full medical workup before they are permitted to pursue meditation training. This is absolutely necessary in order to rule out or confirm disease processes that may require immediate medical attention. Listening to your pain includes making intelligent decisions about obtaining proper medical attention. The work of mindfulness needs to be carried out in conjunction with all the other medical treatments that may be required to relieve pain. It is not meant to be a substitute for medical treatment, but it can be a vital complement to it. Just as we saw earlier that stress per se is not bad, it is important to remember that pain per se is not a bad thing either. Pain is one of your body's most important messengers. If you didn't feel pain, you could do great harm to your body by touching a hot stove or a radiator and not even know it. Or you could have a ruptured appendix, for example, and not know that anything was the matter internally. Pain is a very effective teacher. Yet as a society, we seem to have an aversion to pain, even to the thought of pain or discomfort. That is why we are so quick to reach for medicine as soon as we feel a headache coming on, and why we shift posture as soon as a little muscle stiffness generates some discomfort. Aversion to pain is really a misplaced aversion to suffering. Ordinarily, we do not make a distinction between pain and suffering, but there are very important differences between them. Pain is a natural part of the experience of life. Suffering is one of many possible responses to pain. Suffering can come out of either physical or emotional pain. Suffering, too, is perfectly natural. In fact, the human condition is often spoken of as inevitable suffering. But it is important to remember that suffering is only one response to the experience of pain. Even a small pain can produce great suffering in us if we fear that it means we have a tumor or some other frightening condition. Of course, nobody wants to live with chronic pain, but the fact is, it is very widespread. It has been calculated that lower back pain alone costs our society approximately $30 billion a year in treatment and lost productivity. A lingering pain condition can be totally disabling. Pain can erode the very quality of your life. It can grind you down bit by bit, making you irritable, depressed, and prone to self-pity and feelings of helplessness and hopelessness. You may feel that you have lost control of your body and of your ability to earn a living, to say nothing of enjoying the activities that usually give pleasure and meaning to life. What is more, the treatments for chronic pain conditions, while infinitely better and more sophisticated than they were even 20 years ago, are all too often only partially successful. Many people are ultimately told by the doctor or the staff of a pain clinic at the end of a long and often frustrating treatment course, sometimes involving surgery and usually numerous drug treatments, that they are going to have to, quote, learn to live with their pain. But too often they're not taught how. Being told that you have to learn to live with pain should not be the end of the road, it should be the beginning. In our hospital, the pain clinic, before it was disbanded in the mid-90s, referred many of the patients it treated to the stress reduction clinic for meditation training. The deciding factor in who was referred was the willingness of the patient to try to do something for himself or herself to cope with some of the pain, particularly when it has not responded fully to medical treatment alone. People whose attitude is that they just want the doctor to fix it or make it go away are not good candidates. They won't understand the need to take some responsibility themselves for improving their condition. When something is wrong with a machine, you have to find out what the problem is and you fix it. But your body is not a machine. One problem with chronic pain conditions is that often it is not clear exactly what is causing the pain. Often doctors won't be able to say with certainty why a person is experiencing pain. In our culture, we are not so familiar with the notion of ways or paths. It is a concept that comes from China. The notion of a universal law of being called the Tao, or simply the way. The Tao is the world unfolding according to its own laws. Nothing is done or forced. Everything just comes about. To live in accord with the Tao is to understand non-doing and non-striving. Your life is already doing itself. The challenge is whether you can see in this way and live in accordance with the way things are, to come into harmony with all things in all moments. This is the path of insight, of wisdom, and of healing. It is the path of acceptance and peace. It is the path of the mind-body looking deeply into itself and knowing itself. It is the art of conscious living, of knowing your inner resources and your outer resources, and knowing also that fundamentally there is neither inner nor outer. We may not have gotten these messages as children, but it is not too late. Any time that you decide that it is time to connect up to the domain of your own wholeness is the right time to start. Strange as it may seem, this is the real work that we invite the people who are referred by their doctors to the stress reduction clinic to engage in. It is the exploring of the notion that there is a way of being, a way of living, a way of paying attention that is like starting afresh, that is liberating in and of itself right now, within all one's suffering and the turmoil of life. But to explore it as an idea or a philosophy would be a dead exercise in thinking, just more ideas to fill our already overcrowded minds. You are being invited, in the same spirit as our patients, to work at making the domain of being an ally in your own life, to walk the path of mindfulness and see for yourself how things change when you change the way you are in your body and in the world. As we saw at the very beginning, it is an invitation to embark on a lifelong journey, an invitation to see life as an adventure in awareness. This adventure has all the elements of a heroic quest, a search for yourself along the path of life. It may sound far-fetched to you, but we see our patients as heroes and heroines in the Greek sense, on their own personal odysseys, battered about by fates and the elements, and now, in their willingness to embark upon this journey of wholeness, finally treading the path toward home. As it turns out, we don't have far to look for ourselves on this quest. At any moment, we are very close to home, much closer than we think. If we can just realize the fullness of this moment, of this breath, we can find stillness and peace right here. We can be at home right now, in our body, as it is. When you walk the path of awareness, you are bringing a systematic consciousness to the experience of living that only makes living more full, more real. The fact that no one ever taught you how to do this or told you that it was worth doing is immaterial. When you are ready for this quest, it finds you. It is part of the way, with a capital W, for things to unfold like this. Each moment truly is the first moment of the rest of your life. Now really is the only time you have to live. To begin walking as a formal meditation practice, you should make the specific intention to do it for a period of time, say 10 minutes, in a place where you can walk slowly back and forth in a lane. To keep mindfulness strong, it's a good idea to focus your attention on one aspect of your walking. So if you have decided to pay attention to your feet, then you should stay with the feet for that entire walking period. When my children were babies, I did a lot of enforced walking meditation. It took place in the house late at night, holding one of them on my shoulder, back and forth, back and forth. Since I had to be walking the floors with them anyway, using it as an occasion to meditate helped me to be present 100% with what was happening. There are probably circumstances of one kind or another in your life in which you have to be walking, whether you like it or not. These can be wonderful occasions to bring awareness to your walking and thereby transform it from a dull, mostly unconscious chore into something rich and nurturing. Once you have practiced walking mindfully as a formal exercise and you have some experience of what is involved, you will find that you can easily practice a more informal mindfulness of walking in many different circumstances. For instance, when you park your car and go into stores to do errands or shopping, that is a good occasion to try walking to where you're going with a continuity of awareness. So often, when we have routine errands to do, we feel impelled to rush from one to the next until we get them all done. This can be exhausting, even depressing, because of the monotony of what we are doing if the places we go are the same old places we find ourselves all the time. The mind craves something new. But if we bring awareness to our walking during these routine tasks, it will short-circuit the automatic pilot mode and make our routine experiences more vivid and actually more interesting and leave us calmer and less exhausted at the end. In summary, any time you find yourself walking is a good time to practice mindfulness. But sometimes it's good to find an isolated spot and do it formally as well, back and forth, step by step, moment by moment, walking gently on the earth, in step with your life, being exactly where you are. Peacefulness is something that can be felt in any moment, under any circumstances, if the commitment to practice mindfulness is strong. It is a great gift we can give to ourselves. It means we can reclaim our entire life rather than just living for our vacations or the other special times when everything will be perfectly arranged to bring on those hoped-for feelings of inner peace and serenity. For some time, it was thought that there was conclusive evidence that there was indeed a particular behavior pattern associated with increased risk of coronary heart disease, known as type A behavior. But further research showed that in all likelihood it is not the entire type A pattern as originally described, but only one aspect of it that's related to heart disease. Type A's are described as driven by a sense of time urgency and competitiveness. They are characteristically impatient, hostile, and aggressive. Many studies confirm the connection between type A behavior pattern and coronary heart disease, and demonstrated that it was true for women as well as for men. But other studies, particularly those by Dr. Redford Williams of Duke University Medical School and his collaborators, looked at just the hostility component of the type A behavior pattern and found it to be a stronger predictor of heart disease all by itself than the full type A pattern. In other words, the evidence suggests that you are at less risk of disease as a type A if you are low in hostility, even if you feel a strong time urgency and are competitive. What is more, high hostility scores predicted not just myocardial infarction and death from heart disease, they also predicted increased risk of death from cancer and all other causes as well. Evidence supporting the importance of social connections for health has been bolstered by several major studies of very large populations in this country and abroad over the past 20 years, keeping in mind that this book was first published in 1990. All show a relationship between ties to others and health. People who have a very low degree of social interaction in their lives, as measured by marital status, contacts with extended family and friends, church membership, and other group involvements, are between 2 and 4 times as likely to die in the succeeding 10-year period as are people who have a very high level of social interaction, when all other factors such as age, prior illness, income, health habits such as smoking, alcohol consumption, physical activity, race, and the like are taken into account. One remarkable study of human-animal interaction came about after researchers at the University of Ohio noticed that rabbits on a high-fat, high-cholesterol diet designed to give them heart disease had much less severe heart disease if they were in lower cages in the room rather than in higher ones. This finding didn't make any sense at all. Why should the position of their cages make a difference in the degree of heart disease when the rabbits were all genetically identical, were on the same diet, and were being treated the same way? Then one researcher observed that they were not being treated exactly the same way. It turned out that one of the members of the team was taking out the rabbits in the lower cages from time to time, stroking them and talking to them. This led the researchers to perform a carefully controlled experiment, petting some rabbits and not others while keeping them all on the same high-fat, high-cholesterol diet. The results demonstrated conclusively that affectionate stroking of rabbits made them much more resistant to heart disease than their unpetted kin. The petted rabbits had 60% less severe disease than the unpetted ones. They repeated the whole experiment the second time to make sure it wasn't a fluke and got exactly the same result. Mindfulness practice provides an opportunity to walk along the path of your own life with your eyes open, awake instead of half unconscious, responding consciously in the world instead of reacting automatically and mindlessly. The end result is subtly different from the other way of living, in that we know that we are walking a path, that we are following a way, that we are awake and aware. No one dictates to you what that path is. No one is telling you to follow my way. The whole point is that there is only one way, but that way manifests in as many different ways as there are people and customs and beliefs. Our real job, with a capital J, is to find our own way, sailing with the winds of change, the winds of stress and pain and suffering, the winds of joy and love, until we realize that we have also never left port, that we are never far from our real selves. There is no way to fail in this work if you pursue it with sincerity and constancy. Meditation is not relaxation spelled differently. If you do a relaxation exercise and you aren't relaxed at the end, then you have failed in some sense. But if you are practicing mindfulness, then the only thing that is really important is whether you are willing to look and to be with things as they are in any moment, including discomfort and tension and your ideas about success and failure. If you are, then there is no failure. Similarly, if you are facing the stress in your life mindfully, you cannot fail in your responses to it. Just being aware of it is a powerful response, one that changes everything and opens up new options for growth and for doing. But sometimes those options don't manifest right away. It may be clear what you don't want to do, but not clear yet what you do want to do. These are not times of failure either. They are creative moments, moments of not knowing, moments to be patient, centered in not knowing. Even confusion and despair and agitation can be creative. We can work with them if we are willing to be in the present from moment to moment with awareness. This is Zorba's dance in the face of the full catastrophe. It is a movement that carries us beyond success and failure to a way of being that allows the full spectrum of our life experiences, our hopes and our fears, to play itself out within the field of our own living. The way of awareness has a structure to it. In this audiobook, we have gone into its structure in some detail. We've touched on how it is connected to health and healing, to stress, pain, and illness, and to all the ups and downs of the body, the mind, and life itself. It is a path to be traveled, to be cultivated through daily practice. Rather than a philosophy, it is a way of being, a way of living your moments and living them fully. This way only becomes yours as you travel it yourself. Mindfulness is a lifetime's journey along a path that ultimately leads nowhere, only to who you are. The way of awareness is always here, always accessible to you, in each and every moment. This is Jon Kabat-Zinn. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Full Catastrophe Living, Using the Wisdom of Your Body and Mind to Face Stress, Pain, and Illness. This program was directed by Lewis Milgram, executive producer Sherry Huber, abridgment by Virginia Noonan. This program was edited at John Marshall Sound. Text copyright 1990 by Jon Kabat-Zinn, PhD. Production copyright 2008, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.